The state budget for the next fiscal year in Arizona included more than $100 million in cuts to public universities. So will tuition go up? I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with the chair of Arizona's Board of Regents, Mark Killian, about what options the universities have to raise money. Also, how should so-called dreamers be treated when it comes to tuition rates? Plus, two of the Phoenix Suns' more prominent players, twin brothers Markieff and Marcus Morris, have been indicted on felony aggravated assault charges. What's the organization going to do, and how should teams in general respond when their players are accused of crimes? Also, last week we told you about a Mormon conference that included several people who chose to stand in opposition to some church policies. One of those people is a Mesa resident, and we'll hear his story. And singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb first hit the national scene in the 1990s with a tune called Stay. She's coming to the Valley this weekend. We'll talk about her career and the creative process. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Republican-led Senate projecting a vote today on legislation that assists victims of human trafficking, but lawmakers have a long list of amendments to get through before final action is taken. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says approval of the bill is long overdue.
The filibuster is finally at an end. Today is a new day. A new day. Today we'll finally vote to deliver much-needed resources for the victims of modern slavery.
The bill had appeared set for passage earlier this year until Democrats raised concerns about language that they said could have led to an expansion of existing restrictions on spending federal funds for abortions. And the Democrats railed against the GOP for holding up a confirmation vote on Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch. That may now be held as early as tomorrow. New York City is planning to cut its waste by 90% by the year 2030. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports New York's mayor announced the plan while marking Earth Day in the nation's largest city.
The average New Yorker throws out almost 24 pounds of trash every week. It adds up to more than 6 million tons from the city each year. Mayor Bill de Blasio says it's time to cut those numbers down.
The whole system was built on a bankrupt idea that you produce a huge amount of waste and you go send it to a landfill in another state. That is ludicrous.
De Blasio admits reducing the amount of trash sent to landfills will take years, if not decades. Still, the city plans to create a program to reward New Yorkers for recycling and make it easier by collecting paper, metal, and plastic together. There are also plans to expand composting and reducing the number of plastic bags. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News, New York.
Despite the wind-down announced yesterday by the Saudi government, coalition airstrikes continue to target Houthi rebels in Yemen. NPR's Leila Fadel reports Yemen's former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, a Houthi ally, says stopping the bombardment is a crucial step.
The former president said on his Facebook page that he hoped an end to the violence would mean Yemeni factions could begin negotiating a settlement to end the conflict. Saleh's military allies have been fighting alongside Houthi rebels who control the capital and other parts of the country. But there have been more airstrikes targeting Houthi fighters, although much fewer. Saudi had said it would target Houthi fighters if necessary. Fighting also continues between Houthis and militias who oppose them in the south. Saudi's ambassador to the UK said that this new phase in Yemen is not a ceasefire, but a shift to move toward UN-facilitated talks. Leila Fadel, NPR News, Riyadh.
At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 74 points, nearly half a percent at 18,024. NASDAQ gaining 16, it's at 5,030. S&P 500 up 10 at 2107. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the financial services firm of Raymond James. For over 50 years, offering wealth management, banking, and capital markets expertise with a focus on putting the client's financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. This is the second day of a civil contempt hearing against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio for violating a court's orders in a racial profiling suit. But the sheriff's longtime lawyer, Tom Liddy, is not expected in court. He announced yesterday he intends to withdraw from the case. His action comes just months after another Maine attorney defending Arpaio also withdrew. Mel McDonald is representing Arpaio criminally.
The two most knowledgeable people on this case were Tim Casey and Tom Liddy, and now they're both gone.
Plaintiffs told the judge they don't want Liddy's unexpected departure to slow down the hearing or their pending discovery requests. The Arizona Supreme Court has upheld laws aimed at requiring what are known as dark money groups to disclose those paying for their commercials. The decision came in a last-minute commercial run ahead of the Attorney General's race in 2010. The ad backed Democrat Felicia Rotellini against eventual winner Republican Tom Horn. Thomas Collins of the Citizens Clean Elections Commission says the decision will have considerable relevance in the future.
You won't be able to evade election-related disclosures by pretending like your advertisement is not election-related.
Tom Irvine, who represents the committee that challenged the law, did not immediately return calls seeking comment.
From the KJZZ Newsroom, I'm Catherine Fricke. A new study will assess childhood obesity along the U.S.-Mexico border. In Arizona, Mariposa Community Health Center in Nogales, along with teams from New Mexico and Texas, are participating in the project. A five-year, nearly $5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture will look at child-onset diabetes and the dramatic increases of other chronic conditions late in life.
We'll see sunny skies today in the valley, a high near 86 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy both tomorrow and Friday. The high both days expected to be 81, and we've got a 20% chance for some rain.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts, mixing bluegrass, country, and gospel. Daly and Vincent performs April 24th under the stars in Scottsdale Civic Center Amphitheater. ScottsdalePerformingArts.org.
Skies are mostly sunny over Phoenix, and it's 78 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, are Canadian investors and part-time residents falling out of love with Valley Real Estate? I'll find out from realtor and Canadian-American Diane Brennan. Also, what goes into leaving an organized religion, one that's been at the core of your life and your family's life? We'll talk to a Mesa resident about moving on from the LDS Church. Plus, singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb had her biggest hit 2 decades ago with Stay. She's still going strong and will be performing in Scottsdale this weekend. We'll find out about her creative process and her very identifiable eyeglasses. We start today's program with university funding in Arizona and how state budget cuts could affect tuition. And the State Board of Regents is also considering whether to give so-called Dreamers something of a break on in-state tuition. On Tuesday, Governor Doug Ducey didn't say which way he'd go on the issue.
I've already said where I am on this. I want to see opportunity for all, but I also want to see us follow the law. So I want to see what the Regents propose, and then we're going to review it in full.
That was Governor Doug Ducey yesterday, and now joining me for a few minutes is Mark Killian, Chair of the Board of Regents. Mr. Killian, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad to be with you today.
Glad to have you back. So is tuition going to have to go up at ASU, U of A, and NAU?
I wish I could say no, but to a large degree with the cuts that we received from the legislature, we've got some real challenges ahead of us. And so the Regents are taking the proposals from the universities, and we're going to look at those very carefully. And on Monday, we will do some in-depth analysis of what happens if we don't raise tuition and if there's some gradients of that that we could do. But I wouldn't say that all the Regents right now are ready to vote for a tuition increase.
With all the research that goes into this and looking at the state budget, obviously as a former lawmaker yourself, is this something that you're hoping, or that could possibly be a year or two and then other options can be found, or that perhaps more lobbying of the legislature could change some minds?
Well, we're at a kind of an interesting point in the history of higher education in Arizona, because we're going backwards in the general fund support of our in-state students, and it's really at almost an all-time low. And we need to have a policy discussion, and that discussion needs to occur between the Regents and the governor and the legislative leadership on just where Arizona is going to go and support a higher education. For me, I think we need to reverse the trend. I think we need more general fund dollars into the universities to drive down the cost of tuition so that we don't create barriers to education to anyone in this state.
Yeah, how concerned are you when it comes to tuition? Obviously, it's not on a one-track situation here. It's not that tuition is going up so everyone can celebrate that. It has to do with budget cuts at the state level. But is this going to be a situation where, as we've reached a time where people want to have more college graduates to make the state more competitive in the global economy, is this a possibility of setting Arizona back, even with budget cuts, for just another year or two?
Well, I think it does. For example, our tuition is not as high as other states, but in my mind, that's not how you judge where your tuition needs to be. as far as I'm concerned, our tuition should be as low as possible. And our objective should be an inclusive policy that gets as many people into higher education as possible. Right now in Arizona, only 200 people per 10,000 are attending universities. In Utah, it's 400 people per 10,000. In Texas, it's even higher. And so every time you raise tuition, it creates another barrier. And in our state, and as I read the Constitution, I think the Founding Fathers, their whole objective was to reduce any barrier as much as possible so you can educate as many people as possible.
Is this even more striking considering that Arizona being a relatively young state and also not offering as many options that are not related to the public universities? Yes, there are a few, but there aren't that many. Does it make it even more striking when tuition goes up as drastically as it has in recent years?
Oh, absolutely. There's two things that happen. There's reality and then there's perception. Let's deal with perception for a second. A lot of people won't even apply to go to the university because they hear tuition's going up. It discourages them right from the very beginning. The other part is we do have some financial aids that we do within the system itself to help people, but still there are barriers out there. And as far as I'm concerned, why should someone have to borrow a bunch of money to get their college education? And even though we're below the national average on money borrowed by our students, as far as I'm concerned, that's a non-starter. Education ought to be as free as possible. I really believe in that statement in the Constitution.
It's Here and Now in KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A couple of more minutes left with Mark Killian, chair of Arizona's Board of Regents. Mr. Killian, we've been hearing about whether so-called dreamers, what sort of tuition, in-state tuition, they may pay. The regents have been talking about a possible plan for that. What plan do you support?
Well, they're not going to get in-state tuition for two reasons. One, Proposition 300 precludes that. So what we tried to do was come up with a tuition, and I would consider it a variance of out-of-state tuition, that lowers the cost to those students. Typically, if they were an out-of-state student, they'd pay $25,000, $26,000 a year. Under our policy, they'll pay somewhere between $15,000 and $16,000. They'll pay the full freight. It won't be subsidized by the taxpayers, but at least it drives the cost down and it makes it a little bit easier for those folks to get a college education.
Are you worried about controversy on this topic at all?
Everything we do, there's controversy. I mean, as far as the Board of Regents go, if we even blink our eyes, there's a controversy. So I think most people, when they analyze what's going on here, and most of these kids have lived here their whole lives. They've never been back to their parents' home country. All of us as taxpayers have invested in these children because they've been through our public schools. And the quickest way to bring them up out of poverty is to give them an opportunity to get a higher education. And I think that's a great thing. And many of these are first-generation kids that want to go to college. They want to work. They want to contribute. They want to pay taxes. And, you know, when you analyze that, I don't see why we need to create any more barriers for them than we need to.
Now, you have been very outspoken, and I know you've heard the political buzz. There was some concern that you've been appointed to direct the Department of Agriculture, that as the chair of the Board of Regents, you will quiet your criticism. And yet, to me, a lot of your criticism was directed more at the legislature. Are you feeling like people are sort of holding you up to a higher standard? Are they giving you a hard time? Do you feel like you can still be a critic?
Well, I can be a critic. If you look over my legislative career, I'm fairly outspoken. And there's a difference between criticizing policy and doing personal attacks, and I've never believed in personal attacks. And most of my criticism has been at the policy of the legislature. And my role, whether it's at the Board of Regents or Department of Agriculture, is to advance Arizona's policy. And I believe in higher education. I always have. I think I'm a product of it. I've seen what it does in the lives of my friends. And as far as Arizona goes, the best thing we can do for this state is have the very best universities in the nation, if not the world. And that's the standard I'm pushing. And I know not everyone's going to agree with that, but that's what democracy is. You get a chance to talk and speak your mind and let people know how you feel. And just because I'm the director of agriculture doesn't mean I've stopped loving the universities. I have a great affection for what they do for the people of Arizona.
And finally, if we're just talking about budget and funding, are you optimistic or pessimistic about university funding going forward?
I'm numb. I'm still black and blue from the last session. I'm hopeful that we can have a constructive discussion with the governor's staff. In fact, I know we are. In fact, the governor came to the Board of Regents and said, hey, we got to solve this problem. And I'm hopeful that with those discussions and the discussions we'll have with legislative leadership that we can push an agenda along here that's going to solve a lot of these problems. If we don't, I think you're going to see a whole bunch of people go to the ballot and put something on the ballot that may or may not solve our problems just because they're frustrated. So from a public policy standpoint, the more we can solve at the legislature through legislative and budget policy, the better off we're going to be.
Mark Killian, Chair of the Arizona Board of Regents. Mr. Killian, thanks for the time.
Thank you for letting me visit with you.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Governor Doug Ducey had a special signing ceremony this morning for House Bill 2135 related to rideshare services like Uber and Lyft. But there are other issues the governor has his eyes on. To talk about a couple of those, I'm joined by Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
So why did Governor Ducey decide that HB 2135 needed to get kind of that special treatment of the public signing ceremony?
Well, this really fits in with a theme of something the governor has been trying to promote since he took office, which has been, you know, Arizona open for business, wants Arizona to be very welcome to especially like innovative kind of entrepreneurial businesses that are kind of with kind of newer business models. You know, Uber and Lyft certainly fits the bill for that. That was one of his first actions as governor, was to order the Department of Weights and Measures to stop enforcing some of these rules that had kind of hindered them and not really allowed them to operate and was legal of capacities. You know, he did the same thing for microbreweries with a big bill signing a few weeks ago, allowing them to increase production. I did the same thing with a bill allowing the people to get blood tests without a doctor's orders. I did a bill signing over at this laboratory company out in Scottsdale. So this is a kind of a theme that we've been seeing, you know, from Governor Ducey since he took office.
Did the governor pass out any special pens today?
I don't think so. Okay. But he did sign a bill on the hood of an Uber or Lyft car. I've never seen a governor do that before.
Wow. Okay. I haven't either. Interesting. So earlier this week, Jeremy, you wrote extensively about renewed efforts for a so-called open primary system in Arizona. What did the leaders of that effort tell you? And in part, how is this going to be different than the last time where it really lost by a number of points?
about a 2-to-1 margin, if I recall.
Yes.
And you know, there's a few things they want to do differently, one of which is there'll be some different language to the bill. Now, that is not finalized yet. They're still working on that. There are a couple of kind of X factors, one of which being this Supreme Court ruling that's pending, I think, in June on redistricting and kind of the meaning of the U.S. Constitution's Elections Clause. Now, they expect to have more funding. They have backing from a national group that's going to be helping them out on the ground out here. And you know, going back to the changed language, that's kind of the one thing we're not entirely sure what that will look like. Right now they've got a draft that's very similar to the top two primary measure from 2012, Proposition 121. And the one major change that they've got in that so far is in 2012 the measure had all the candidates in the primary had their party affiliation next to their name. You know, everyone is in one blanket primary, and the top two vote getters, regardless of party, would go on to the general election. And they got hit a lot from opponents saying, "Oh, well, we could have, you know, two Democrats on the ballot in the general election or something like that." And they felt like that really hurt them. And so their solution to that is to take the party affiliations off of the ballot altogether, kind of like in a like a municipal election. And they seem to, I'm not sure how much of a difference that will make. I certainly don't think that's going to make up a, you know, 2-to-1 difference. But they seem to feel like this is a pretty significant change, and there may be others.
Is this one of those situations where there are more people who are optimistic in that camp about Arizona being kind of a purple state when reality maybe suggests otherwise?
I think the top two primary movement for all these folks is kind of more than that. I mean, part of it is kind of centrist leadership. I mean, there's certainly a thought that a top two primary will eliminate kind of the extremes on both sides. But for them, what this is, one of the main things this is about is independent voters, who, of course, now outnumber either Republicans or Democrats in Arizona. And I think that's kind of a national trend. And they feel like the system is kind of rigged against them, you know, although Now, independents can vote in partisan primaries in Arizona, but they don't get they don't automatically get a ballot in the same way that Republicans or Democrats or Libertarians do. And they just feel like the system's kind of set up so it's harder for them to participate. And this is their solution to kind of help alleviate that.
And it's something a little bit unrelated to that, but even after some sort of clamor to change it, the Republican Party in the state this week did decide to go ahead and continue to let independents vote in their primaries. How big a controversy would that have been if that wasn't able to go forward?
Well, I think if the Republican Party had moved to close those primaries to independents, that would have been quite the arrow for the open primary folks. That would have been kind of a perfect example for them to say, you know, the system's closed off to independents and it's getting even more closed. You can't vote in the primary of the state's, largest and predominant party. Now, the Republican Party's executive committee decided not to spend the money on that. They had a motion at their meeting on Saturday that would have authorized up to $75,000 in party funds, to initiate this lawsuit. They decided more or less that their funds would be better spent elsewhere. I'm sure there might have been some concerns over kind of how that would look publicly. We had Senator McCain just a couple weeks ago supporting the continued participation of independents in the Republican primary. And so that pretty much may end the issue for now. I'm sure we'll see it come up again, though, because a lot of the grassroots conservatives in the party are really adamant about wanting to close the primary to anyone but registered Republicans.
Jeremy, one final thing, and I would never, of course, ask you to scoop yourself, but you did get a chance to talk with Governor Ducey after the signing ceremony today. Anything we should be looking for that you'll be reporting on later today?
You can catch it all in our the Arizona Capital Times annual session wrap edition that comes out at the end of next week.
What? So not even one little hint?
I have to read.
Okay. Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks as always.
No problem. See you. Thanks a lot.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about whether Canadian folks are losing interest in Valley real estate. And later this hour, singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb joins us. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, presenting the Economic Outlook Luncheon on May 6th. Economists will discuss the local and national economy and the 2016 forecast. Registration at econclubphx.org.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us for NewsHour from the BBC today at 1, and then at 2, it's the world. Mostly sunny skies across the state right now, and it's expected to stay that way for the rest of the day. Right now it's 63 degrees in Prescott, 76 in Tucson, 75 in Casa Grande. It's also 75 in Yuma, 55 degrees in Flagstaff. Well, public radio reporters are also public radio listeners. Over the next few weeks, a KJZZ staff member will share a story they liked from Morning Edition. See what others are listening to on Morning Edition by visiting our Facebook page or KJZZ.org and look for the I Like This Story post. Right now, with 18% relative humidity, we have mostly sunny skies in Phoenix, and it's 78 degrees at 11:23.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Ray Rice's arrest for domestic violence received some of the biggest headlines, but arrests of professional athletes aren't necessarily rare. A couple of Atlanta Hawks players ran into a law enforcement problem earlier this month, and one of them suffered a season-ending injury. As of yesterday, the Phoenix Suns are now dealing with serious allegations against two of their more prominent players. Twin brothers Marcus and Markeith Morris have been indicted on felony aggravated assault charges for a January 24th incident. With me to talk about the legal challenges for pro athletes and sports organizations is Rodney K. Smith, professor of practice at ASU's O'Connor College of Law. He is director of the college's sports law and business program. Professor Smith, people know about now the indictments against the Morris twins of the Phoenix Suns, and there's the focus on the criminal situation, how that could affect their lives. But even beyond that, give us some more details about what they may face in many other legal realms and even facing their employer.
Yes, Steve, this is a much broader than just the criminal action. They begin with the criminal action. If they are found guilty, the burden is the proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If that happens, and it will probably happen anyway, there will be a civil action in all likelihood brought against them. In that civil action, because of the higher standard of proof in the criminal action, they won't even have to prove the guilt piece. They'd just be proving up the damages, the plaintiff. Then the league, through Commissioner Silver's office, can intervene in the interests of the NBA And they have done just that in the past. Recently, though it was for domestic assault, they suspended Jeff Taylor of the Hornets for 24 games. But it's not over there. The club, they then have a morals clause in their contract and may be able to act against the players. And so they will be looking at possible actions on a number of fronts. In essence, this will probably be a multi-billion dollar blow if they're found guilty. And of course, they're under a good deal of pressure to try, I think, to settle this matter and not have the criminal proceedings go forward.
There's that clear damage of what the accuser is saying the Morris twins did, but in a more business-related sense, the organization can face, it can hurt their brand to be associated with players who were accused or guilty of things like this. I recall when Jerry Colangelo was owner of the Suns, there were times, and I don't know if he did this every time, but certainly there were clear examples when a player did something or was accused of something, he was quick to try to find another address for that player. So what's the pressure on an organization when something like this comes to light?
You really put the emphasis in the right place. Their brand begins to be questioned within the community, and they have to be sensitive to protecting their brand, and I think they're already taking steps to do that. One of the good things is this is after the season, and there's a little bit of time to see how things turn out. But their brand is in jeopardy, and of course the players themselves need to be sensitive to their own brands, because this can be very harmful to them in terms of continuing with the Suns or going elsewhere.
Is this something that could potentially hurt the league's reputation as well? And I don't mean specifically necessarily the Morrises, but you mentioned Jeff Taylor. If other cases like this come up, it seems, and I'm just throwing in my own opinion on this, it seems that when a player, for example, gets a DUI, for the most part, people have sort of said, not in so many words, they don't really care that much, but it becomes something, a violent situation, domestic violence or something else, it does seem like fans stand up and take notice to that.
I think there's no question about that. And I think that's why you can anticipate in this matter, if it proceeds much further at all, that the commissioner will get involved. My guess is at some level his office already is in trying to ascertain what has happened. They're very concerned about their brand. Each one of these builds on the last. It's creating a crescendo, if you will, that really tarnishes the brand. And one never knows which blow is going to be the one that's more fatal.
One final question for you, and that is the bigger picture and going forward. When it comes to collective bargaining, for example, are these the types of issues that you think have come up or will come up more often as the league negotiates with the Players Association in any league, could be the NBA or other sports as well, as we start hearing more about these and as the league gets more concerned about its brand and how people perceive it, are we going to start hearing more about these things being built in? You mentioned morals clauses, but I'm not sure that the public in general knew as much about that. Do you think we'll start to know more about what's in those agreements?
Well, I think of necessity we will. And generally, the players' associations have been a little reluctant to get involved. They feel the need to defend their players. Their involvement will be with the commissioner's office to make sure that there's adequate process, due process, to protect the players, because, of course, occasionally these things are proven not to have any merit.
Rodney K. Smith is professor of practice at ASU's O'Connor College of Law. He's director of the College's Sports Law and Business Program. We've been talking about the impact of the indictments of Suns twin brothers Marcus and Markieff Morris. Professor Smith, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. When the Valley's housing market was in deep trouble and full of foreclosures and short sales, investors were heavily involved in taking advantage of the depressed prices. Many of them were Canadians who enjoyed spending time in the warm sun for a few months of the year. But indications are that Canadians are not feeling as much affection for Valley real estate now. What are some of the reasons, and what are we seeing in the market? To figure some of that out, I'm joined by realtor Diane Brennan of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. She's also the radio host of That Real Estate Show, which is on the web at thatrealestateshow.co. And Diane is, amazingly enough, Canadian-American. Diane,
thanks
for being
Thank you for having me.
So why are Canadians not as excited about the Valley's housing market now?
Well, it's completely financial. So with the oil prices dropping, a lot of our Canadians that come here from Alberta, and I refer to Alberta, Canada is the Texas of Canada. So oil prices are dropping, the Canadian dollar is dropping, and therefore they bought when the Canadian dollar was at par with the U.S. dollar back in 2010. So now prices have appreciated so much here that they're going to make a profit on selling their home, but also when they exchange their U.S. dollar back to Canadian, they're going to gain 20 to 30%.
Wow.
So, but we still have a ton of Canadians here that, you know, I joke that pools and palm trees, we're happy. That's all Canadians need. So they, it doesn't matter what price it is, they won't give up their Arizona home. But for a lot of people that were investors, Canadian investors, now's the time for them to cash in, so to speak.
Has this been a slow build or has it been going for the last year or so? Can you talk about the finances?
Well, things have picked up now and the dollar has dropped, and especially with oil prices. So I guess, you know, oil prices started dropping a while ago. So now is the busier time when people are buying and selling. So I do have one client that wants to, he's getting ready, his property's ready to sell. He plans on keeping them in a U.S. account because he expects the Canadian dollar to drop even further. So he's quote-unquote playing the dollar, and then we'll do the exchange.
Okay. Now, so do Canadians do anything any differently than Americans? Do they view the real estate any differently?
Well, we appreciate it a lot just because of the weather here. You know, it's paradise. But no, you know, business is business for a lot of the investors. So just like you Americans, they're going to take a good opportunity to be able to invest and make a profit.
Now, certainly you're not focused just on Canadians, but how does that potentially affect your business?
Well, if they're selling, that's fantastic.
Okay.
Because I'm listing the properties. And, you know, I work with all types of buyers. When I first got into the business, because I'm a dual citizen, that's actually how I built my business. But I work with plenty of Americans and people in the Valley helping them buy and sell their homes. So,
you know, I'm wondering when it comes to the fact that it's financial, as you said, I was thinking about a slightly different track. Like, are there places now that are more attractive for Canadian investors or Canadian folks who want to come to America? Is there a situation where, I presume California is way too expensive, but does Arizona have some real direct competition from other markets?
Well, actually, no, because with the weather, I mean, there are Canadians that are on the East Coast that prefer Florida just because it's a cheaper, you know, a shorter distance to fly to. And Florida was in the same kind of housing crunch that we were. So there was deals there as well. But when it comes to weather, a lot of people can't handle the humidity of Florida and they really appreciate and prefer the dry Arizona air. It's a direct flight from my hometown, Edmonton, Alberta, which is 3.5 hours. And Vancouver, it's a short flight as well, and all of the Western Canadian provinces. So it's easy access. It's quick to get here. And like I say, a pool and a palm tree and maybe a Canadian beer and they're happy, which they can't get down here. But
so again, considering the fact it's financial, is there anything the Valley can do about that to change it up? I mean, is there something that, you know, we always hear about the tourism situation, but I presume, as you said, since Canadian folks still love to come here, whether they're quote unquote snowbirds or not, there really isn't much we can do about it, right? It's more of the world economy?
It's more of the world economy. You know, and it's going to affect our short-term vacation people. A lot of Canadians come here for a week or two. They don't have property here. But with the belt tightening and the job losses happening in Canada over the oil industry, the first things that are going to go, of course, is the, you know, vacations. So we could see an effect of that. But, you know, the colder it gets in Canada during the wintertime, people are going to pay more. They love the sunshine.
Well, so what are you seeing other than that? I know it's maybe anecdotal to some extent, but based on the amount of time you've been a realtor, what have you seen in the last few years that indicates to you, I mean, are we, you know, we both talked to Mike Orr of ASU at various points. are we seeing a more normal market? And if it is a more normal market, how does it affect you?
Well, it's more stable. Mm-hmm. So it has never been a normal market since I've got into the business in 2010. I actually came in the worst time when all real estate agents were giving up their licenses. So I haven't seen normal. So this is pretty much as normal as I have seen. Prices are stable. They're increasing actually right now in some areas. We have, and Michael Orr with ASU will say, there's been, you know, kind of a frenzy market in certain areas of the valley are red hot. Currently, I have clients right now buying in the West Valley, El Mirage, Glendale, Peoria, under the $200,000 mark, multiple offers.
Wow.
So one of my clients, we were up against six other offers. So, I mean, it's frustrating for them. So under certain price ranges, it's really picked up.
And the job market has picked up a bit as well. I would suspect that affects your business.
Yes, that's always good news. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. If we could get the millennials to start buying, average age now is 36, and we're missing our first-time home buyers. So the millennials, there's a big chunk of our first-time home buyers that aren't pulling the trigger and purchasing homes. So
well, we hear about millennials that isn't necessarily the American dream anymore. So
no, they've seen their parents go through foreclosure, short sale, and they're like, I don't want anything to do with that. They're the most fiscally responsible generation, so they're carrying a lot of student loan debt, so they don't want to get into more debt with a mortgage.
So when it comes to Canadian folks, then, are we seeing mostly folks of a closer to retirement age?
Actually, we have a lot of people who even purchased in their early 30s when prices were good so that they will have somewhere to go when they retire. So they're investing, they're renting it out now, and then when they are able to retire and spend a full 6 or 7 months down here, mm-hmm. they want to take advantage of that. So they're pretty savvy.
I want to come back to this weather thing because, of course, that's
huge.
I grew up in Phoenix, so of course I'm used to the sunny weather and I love it. But it does seem like that's still enough to grab people.
Oh well, we take it for granted. You need to come with me to my hometown where it's minus 50 below. Before I moved to Arizona 17 years ago, I was in a place called Fort McMurray, Alberta. It was minus 55 with the wind chill. You could not shut your vehicle off. At all.
Yeah.
You had to keep your vehicle running 24 hours a day. So there was freeze warnings of 20 seconds, which means if you were outside and you were out there for 20 seconds, the inside of your nostrils would start to freeze. So Steve, I welcome you to come up to Canada. I will show you what that's like, and you will definitely appreciate what we have in Arizona.
Is this the same story you tell to potential folks? Hey, listen, I've got a house you want to buy, so come on over from Canada and just think about 55
absolutely. You know what? There's no sales there. You know, there's long winter months. And same with people from the East Coast or the Midwest. Mm-hmm. You get tired of gray skies and cold temperatures. So this is paradise. Everyone, we are living in paradise, and we forget sometimes.
Diane, last thing. Is there something that makes you especially optimistic about the market and especially, you know, just to be honest, is there anything that makes you a little bit nervous?
You know what? I'm not nervous at all. I'm really confident in our market because of our weather here and our great events that we host all year long in the valley, maybe not in the summer so much, but everybody wants to live here. So we're even internationally, we're known as a great destination. So we have Europeans coming here in the summer that want to see the wild, wild west. And across the country, it's a really desired place to live. So I don't think that's ever going to change. And jokingly, I say, you know, California, the three strikes law, we do get, no, I'm kidding. We don't want those. But, you know, it's a desirable place to live. We are a very reasonable cost of living. It's beautiful here. The weather's fantastic. Lots of things to do. We've got a lot to offer people.
Realtor Diane Brennan of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. She's also the radio host of That Real Estate Show, which is on the web at thatrealestateshow.co. I still can't figure that out. Why .co and not .com, Diane?
Well, at first we couldn't afford the M.
Okay. And so. Diane is also Canadian-American. Diane, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll meet singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb. She'll be in the Valley this weekend. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Thailicious, offering traditional dishes like pad thai, Penang curry, and a variety of vegetarian dishes. Located at Ray and Kyrene in Chandler, menu and online ordering available at thailiciousaz.com.
Good morning. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now on KJZZ.org and 91.5 FM. Well, we'll see sunny skies in the valley today. We're expecting a high of 86 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy tomorrow and Friday. The high expected to drop to 81, and we've got a 20% chance of rain both days. NPR's Here and Now is coming up at 12 o'clock. Today, the president and some Democrats are sparring over trade policy, with critics saying free trade hurts U.S. jobs. And who are the smugglers bringing people from Africa to Europe? That's here and now from Boston, starting at noon. Sunny skies and 78 degrees right now in the valley at 11:39.
I don't think it's uncommon.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Last week, we spoke about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints General Conference, where several attendees stood up to express their opposition to the church or its leaders. One of those opposed was Mesa resident Micah Nicolaiason. He's questioned many of the church's teachings for a long time, but has now reached a point where he finds it difficult to be an active church member. I invited him in to talk about what it's like for him to leave a faith that has been such a defining part of his life and identity.
I don't think it's uncommon for other religious traditions to have that religious identity completely intertwined with your own personal identity. And Mormonism is no exception to that. But with Mormonism, there's this cultural heritage, especially if you grow up in Utah, where it's not just a set of beliefs. It's integrated into the culture. And with many of us, it's part of our heritage, and it's a heritage we're very proud of. You know, our ancestors who fled for religious freedom and came to the Salt Lake Valley, and that's something that I'm really proud of, and I'm happy to be a part of that heritage. When I was a teenager, especially, I just always had a harder time with kind of the more meta issues, like the concept of God itself and the disparity of suffering in the world. You know, God was totally willing to help me find my keys when I lost them, but he had a hard time answering prayers for people who had real, genuine, life-threatening needs around the world, and not just a few people, but millions of people. And that's always something I really struggled with and wrestled with, even as a child. But despite all that, I maintained my faith and very devoutly all the way through my adult years. I served a mission for the church for 2 years. Very shortly after I got home from my mission, when I was 22, I got married in the temple. You know, I've always had these looming doubts, and, you know, I had wrestled with a lot of the challenging issues that confront Mormonism, especially with its history and its origins throughout my life. The cracks really started to form for me during Prop 8. It was Prop 102 in Arizona. And at the time, you know, I was a young father, and you know, I had wrestled a lot with the church's stance on LGBT issues. It was hard for me to reconcile, you know, the type of people that I knew were gay and the relationships that they had and the happiness that they had with the way that the church described and framed, you know, different sexual orientations. And I still remember the first church meeting I was at, where somebody from higher up came in and said, hey, this is something that the brethren, which is a reference to the highest church leaders, this is something the brethren support and encourage our local members to support. And so in response to that, we are seeking volunteers to man phone booths, to pass out flyers and things like that. And that really blew my mind. And I had a hard time with it. And the few people I was brave enough to talk to about it basically said, well, I see those same problems too, but we know that if we do what our church leaders tell us to do, we'll be blessed for it. If they end up being wrong, that's on their heads. Mm. I manned the phone booths. I voted in favor of the proposition. And regardless of whether I participated or not, Prop 102 was going to pass in Arizona. But once I saw Prop 8 pass by the slim margin that it did in California, I had this just immediate sense of regret and guilt. And that surprised me. And I also realized that I had taken the Nuremberg defense. I'm just taking orders, you know? And so it was at that point that I sort of promised myself that I would never fall into that trap again, where I would allow what anybody was saying to dissuade me from doing what I felt was right.
Micah, when did you decide that the church was not going to be the same part of your family, your wife, your children, that it was for you? How long ago did you make that decision?
2 summers ago, so that would have been summer 2013.
So what are some of the complications that have come from that? I mean, have there been clear positives or no?
It's interesting because in the church, and especially in the temple, we focus a lot on the Adam and Eve narrative, where you have the first man and woman who basically leave the garden so that they can experience the pain and the joy of mortality as a stepping stone to their eternal progression and as a model for the rest of us. And it's a beautiful analogy. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like I've left the garden. And there have been tremendous struggles and at times an enormous amount of sorrow, more so than I'd ever experienced before. But that has also been reciprocated with an amazing amount of happiness and contentment.
When I look at you and I think about your background, your history with the church, your family's history with the church, and I look at you as just average, I mean this in a nice way, an average white guy.
Yeah, that's me.
And in some, I hope this is not seen as some sort of derogatory way, but the church is kind of made for somebody like you in a sense. So it seems to me it took even more crisis of faith, spine, whatever it is to move on from that. Do you reflect on that as well? I mean,
quite a bit actually. And it's something that I have to be aware of as somebody who advocates for LGBT rights and for gender equality in the church, that I'm coming from a place of privilege. But at the same time, and I don't mean to sound like a victim, it's a lot to give up, you know, because I definitely saw a future in the church where I knew I would serve in leadership positions, and a lot of validation and admiration comes to men who serve in those leadership positions, and it can be a huge social payoff. And actually, that was a conscious thing that I had to think about. Am I willing to let go of that to something that I've been looking forward to for such a long time in my life? And that felt like a measure of success to me, how well I succeeded in sort of climbing the ladder in the Mormon church. In the effort to be an ally for people who are marginalized, you know, you kind of have to keep yourself in check, you know, because you haven't had that experience. I've never been a gay man or a gay woman or just a woman in the church. And so, you know, my ability to, you know, you want to say, I know your pain when you don't, you know?
You know, a number of religions rely on this concept of being saved in some sense, or being able to see your loved ones after you've left this particular existence. So I want to talk about some of the complications of that as well, because you have certainly friends, you have relatives who obviously love you, and probably think that staying in the church would be better for you. So how do you deal with that when it's coming from a good place, as far as they see it, but it doesn't work for you?
That's really at the heart of a lot of the turmoil that comes from this. I always tell people, just use your imagination and try to invent a theological system where the stakes are higher than they are with Mormonism. And Mormonism is very unique in this way, because it's not just about getting baptized or getting married. It's about doing it at the right place through the right authority in order for it to have validity in the eternities. And the church is very focused on family. Most importantly, though, is the concept of eternal family. And so, you know, if you are a father who is, or a mother that is completely devoted and invested in this idea that they want their family to be together forever, and the way to do that is through the church, when one of those children is straying from the faith, mm-hmm. and you know, God forbid, if one of them leaves the church, I mean, it's a crushing failure for them in a lot of ways. And that concern extends from there, you know, it has a ripple effect to grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, old friends, and people do become worried about your salvation. And that often is the catalyst for a lot of the tension and sadly, the ending of marriages, the disowning of children from their family, and sometimes a lot of hatred that's put on the person that's questioning. And I've definitely experienced that myself, and that's been one of the hardest aspects of the whole thing.
One last big philosophical question for you, which is, obviously you're watching it very closely. What do you want to see from the church, whether it's still yours or not? And is there anything that would get you to want to say to your your kids, hey, maybe this isn't such a bad idea?
Well, I will say that even after we stopped attending, there have been a couple times where it felt appealing to go back. And, you know, there are many valuable things that the church has. And it provides community. It provides structure. It teaches a lot of good values. And so there are a lot of things that appeal about having access to that. But, you know, I think there are so many ways that the church can adapt to the changes in society and provide a healthy religious community for people of different sexual orientations, to provide more access to women to voice and influence within the church without compromising its doctrine and its truth claims. You know, I'm not somebody that believes in closing any doors or burning any bridges. And so I'd say there's lots of possibilities in the future. Life is long.
Micah Nicolaisen is a Mesa resident who stood opposed to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints General Conference earlier this month. You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In 1994, singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb became popular and famous with this tune, Stay, from the movie Reality Bites.
You say, I only hear what I want to. You say, I talk so all the time.
Years later, Loeb is still writing and playing music. She's also writing books and musicals and acting. She'll be at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday, and she joins me now. Lisa, how did you feel more than 20 years ago when people were saying you were kind of an overnight sensation?
I saw that a lot when I was in my early 20s, when the song Stayed all of a sudden was being played on the radio and became very popular, went to number one. I heard a lot about it being an overnight success, and that used to frustrate me so much because it's something that I had been working on for so long. You know, I'd been a musician in New York City and in college and played so many gigs and just had been doing it for so long in my mind that, you know, I'd been working toward it, meeting, you know, becoming more involved in the industry as well, like, you know, meeting different business people and A&R people and just sort of doing what you do to become a professional musician, that to hear that I was an overnight success, I was like, what? You know, like I wasn't some pop singer who somebody handed me a song and I sung it and then all of a sudden I was on the radio. So that was a little bit frustrating. But that being said, I quickly learned to just sort of ignore that kind of talk and also understood what the public meant when they said overnight success, because all over the country they didn't know about me or the world. You know, there were a bunch of people in New York City in different pockets that knew me very well, but it hadn't gotten to that level, and it seemed to happen so quickly, you know?
So once you were able to get past that initial annoyance or frustration, do you think in the long term it has been a plus, and how long did it take for you to figure out it was a plus?
You know, that's a good question. I think it probably took me probably until my next record came out and I started getting songs played on the radio. And then that point has been really, I think of it more and more as time goes on and I'm able to look at things in perspective and say, wow, you know, even just having, you know, I've had a handful of songs that have been on the radio, but that was definitely the most popular and the one that people know best. It's a song that gets requested all the time. Luckily for me, it was a song that meant a lot to me as well. It wasn't like a song that somebody made me write. It was a song that came from my heart. It was a song that I was really proud of the way it was recorded. It was a song that people used to love hearing even before it was on the radio. And it was a time, it was a very independent time where we were doing things our way. And it was really cool that the radio played it the way we wanted it to sound. You know, it wasn't like a record company came in and said, you got to do this, you got to do that. They did say, oh, you need to add tambourine, which we were actually going to do anyway. So it was sort of a perfect thing for them to tell us to do.
So as an artist, what does success mean to you then?
You know, I'm very introspective and constantly looking at what do I really want to do. I remember along the way, I was playing a lot of concerts and putting out records and making music, but spending a lot of time getting my hair and makeup done to be on TV and doing things that just didn't feel very valuable to me. But they were definitely part of my job. You know, I was thinking, do I really want to do this? What am I doing? And that kind of thinking sort of helps me keep centered. Like I realized, you know what, some of the things I really, other things I really want to do in life include things that part of that, those other jobs are connecting with people, listening to other people's stories, telling stories, you know, communicating with people. And I realized, wow, I get to do a lot of that through my music. And when I looked at what I was doing through a different sort of point of view, it made me appreciate it a lot more. So that's how I sort of move along in life, and I continue to try to do things that are inspiring to me. I think success as an artist, to me, there's a couple of different things. If you're talking about purely as an artist, mm-hmm. to me that means continuing to work on what I'm trying to do now, which is feeling good about the process of songwriting and continuing to grow as I move along. As a musician, as a professional, success also means making a living and making a good living being a musician. And that's a separate issue, and that doesn't always completely overlap with what it takes to be an artist. It doesn't, for me, I don't put myself in a position where I do things that I can't stand behind and I'm not proud of. But, you know, being a working entertainer and musician is can include different things than just being an artist.
As you've matured, has that inspiration changed? Has the key to inspiration changed? Has your creative process changed?
You know, it's funny. Like, it's actually, I feel like in a way gone backwards. When you first start off and you're a musician, I think also I'm a popular musician in that ever since I was a young child and wrote music, it did feel really great when people responded to my music and liked it. And that's sort of like what popular music is, you know? So there's the artistic part of it, which is just expressing myself, you know? And there's the crafted part, which is making it into something that's well-crafted. But I do like making things that might succeed. But I have to say, as I move forward, the thing that I think achieves that now is to continue to just try to tap into the most simple, you know, communication to continue to, like, try to figure out who I am and what I have to say and what point of view I have or perspective I have on things happening in my own life or in things that I see in the news or stories that I hear that I can help communicate to other people.
When you're in Scottsdale, will you be wearing the trademark glasses? And what's it like to be a performing artist known for music but also known for having a certain look?
It's funny, to go back to the 90s when my songs first started getting played on the radio and journalists mostly wanted to ask me about my glasses, I was so frustrated. I thought, wow, they would never ask Sting about his glasses. They don't even ask Elton John about his glasses, and he's known for his glasses. And I was like, wow, that's really not cool. Like, I'm a serious musician. I play guitar, and I write songs, and I sing, and I produce my records and work on my videos and all this stuff. In retrospect, again, like in the world of branding and marketing, I have to say, what a wonderful surprise that something that I do naturally, that I connect with naturally, that I need on my face, my glasses, the Lisa Loeb glasses, that's the, you know, it's almost like this branding, it's like I hired somebody to brand myself, but it's just really something that I do. So I don't mind it to have something that's naturally connected to me that usually leads them back to my music. It's great. It's totally, I don't mind it at all.
You mentioned Sting and Elton John. So did you feel like when you were making the music, you were at that age, that there was pressure for you to be a cute girl kind of thing?
You know, I went to an all-girl school growing up, and I was always sort of imbued with the idea that, you know, you needed to be yourself and, you know, feminism and, you know, it's not about, like, what you look like and it's about what you're doing. That being said, a lot of the musicians I loved growing up, like the Police with their bright blonde hair and Elton John with his crazy outfits and glasses and David Bowie with his constantly evolving looks, to me, that was part of the intrigue of some of those bands I loved, and it definitely didn't take away from their music. So it was kind of like this post-feminist thing where I was like, you know what? I want to wear short skirts, and I want to have this certain kind of style. Growing up in Dallas, which is sort of like Arizona and Phoenix and Scottsdale, where people are aware of how they look. You know, you got to put on your lipstick before you leave the house. That's how I was raised, and it's part of who I am, and it's a lot of fun to figure out, like, fashion and style and, you know, what works. I still think the music is the, you know, is the core of being a musician.
And Lisa, one final question for you. You've been referenced in pop culture a lot lately, on TV with Orange is the New Black and the film Hot Tub Time Machine 2. Are you reaching a new generation, and how does that feel?
I am. You know, when I go play concerts, which I'm always often on tour. As a mom with two young children, I really try to spend as much time in Los Angeles with them as I can, obviously. But when I am on tour, I meet people of all different ages, people who are new fans, who are in their early 20s, mid-20s, fans whose parents used to be fans, who are even younger through my kids' music. A lot of the same fans I had from 20 years ago are still with me. So it's really cool to have such a really a wide base of people who come to see shows. It seems like literally people of all ages come to see shows and enjoy the music, and it's good. It's cool. It feels very current, even when I get to play songs like Stay, which is from 20 years ago.
Singer-songwriter Lisa Loeb, she'll be in Scottsdale this Saturday, April the 25th at 7:30 as part of a concert on Stars at the Scottsdale Civic Center Amphitheater. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Hope to see you there.
And that's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. And thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear one of our previous editions or segments, you can go online later this afternoon to kjzz.org, or you can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. Now it's time for NPR's Here and Now on listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD, a service of Rio Salado College. I'm Steve Goldstein. Again, thanks so much for listening, and have a great afternoon.